So I want to talk about a couple experiences I've had recently, which reveal this sort of great and rich space between and amongst place, power, and identity, and the way we get configured participate in how in a space, and the way different spaces ask different things of us and coerce us. One of the things that's always sort of struck me is, you walk down a street. I walked down Valencia Street in San Francisco. You walk down there in an evening, which I no longer recommend, and there's all these restaurants. And what's incredible is there's so many different restaurants, and at each one, the behavior is the same. Right? Everyone's doing the same thing. People are lined up and waiting for a table. There are people at a table. Everyone's seated around a table. There's the volume of talk is pretty homogeneous. A certain restaurant might be louder than another due to acoustics. But the behavior of people is strikingly uniform. What that immediately sort of tells one is that there's a discourse of power there. There is a way bodies are distributed, and there are limit terms of the behavior, right? You can't all of a sudden, lie down on the floor in a restaurant, stretch out on the table. You can't get naked. You can't get really rowdy. Just stand up. When I'm alone at home eating, sometimes I just want to stand up. In the middle of eating, I just want to stand up and walk around a bit. I might stand up and walk around and sit on a different chair in a different room. That's not behavior that a restaurant would, it's not that it wouldn't tolerate, although it wouldn't tolerate it. What's even more peculiar is that people just wouldn't do it. No doubt there are these triggers for forces that, that exceed us. If you get up and start yelling, first a waiter, and then maybe another patron, and then the manager, and finally the police, right? The armed state, right? And that's the most very explicit expression of power. But the more insidious, the more complex, and in a way the more efficient form of power is you and me, and going into these spaces and assuming those are things we do not do. In fact, we assume them so much. Of course we don't do them. You can't even say, of course we don't do them. It's even before that. It's an always, already, never having been thought. And that, of course, is the conception of power that interests Foucault and, continues to interest me and define sort of how I see the world functioning, right? Everywhere you go, different identities you assume, but certainly spaces ask certain things of us, demand certain things of us, set up limit terms, set up all kinds of opportunities too. They're not dictatorially fascistic controlling spaces, although some restaurants can be more so than others in that capacity. So you get two things here. One is the way that a place is itself an expression of a power. That's not necessarily the power of the state. It's simply this distribution of bodies and behaviors, with the state at the armed state and the police state at one limit term of one kind of behavior, but there are many other kinds of behavior that wouldn't summon the police, right? Immediately shows us that there are other kinds of laws at work besides besides the laws of the state, other kinds of coercions, other kinds of dictates of how we are, how we sit and stand towards each other and ourselves in public space. I find this, this expression of the definition of space changes, and it changes space to space, and even within the category of a space, there'll be these different sort of distributions of bodies, these different limit terms of behavior. One for me is, you know, bars. I like to go out alone. I'm not shy about my will to solitude, but sometimes I like to be out and about rather than just home, and I like to, you know, sit at a bar, and there's a certain kind of bar where sitting alone, particularly after a certain hour in the later evening, in which it simply feels uncomfortable. You know, I go in some hipster bar in the Mission. I can go in there at like 5 and sit there alone, right? Because who goes into the bar right at 5? It's those guys who really need a drink, right? It's the drunks. And so it's sort of assumed there's a certain moment in which a space allows a certain behavior. As the evening goes on and the bar starts to fill up with, you know, 28-year-old project managers and brand managers and coders, being there alone becomes an odd thing. And again, there's no rule against it. And this is the point at which identity, behavior, the sort of social semiotics, space, and power all intersect there. And it really are the same thing. They're constitutive of the same network of just how we go in the world. So again, for myself, if I'm going to a bar alone, again, I'll go to a so-called hipster bar, meaning a bar frequented by middle class and upper middle class, 20 to 35-year-olds. But I go early and I'll have a drink, and I, you know, I can sit there and read or write alone. It doesn't seem too weird. Otherwise, I've always felt sort of welcome in Irish bars. Right? There's a different discourse of power. There's a different distribution of bodies in an Irish bar. There's nothing strange about a guy sitting there alone having a drink. It doesn't need to be explained. And again, I'm allowed to sit in those other bars. There's no legislative difference. And yet the spaces ask different things of us and allow different things without a certain discomfort or a certain disease coming upon us. And again, this is where identity, the space, and power all become this kind of cooperative event of life, of social space, and our participation in it. Doesn't mean you can't break it. And I know people who enjoy entering a space where there's a certain expectation that they like to fuck with. They like to be louder in a softer space, or move around, or, you know, I have a good friend, you know, he walks in a space and he immediately asks them to change the music, configure the space to his liking. I've always sort of enjoyed that about him, and he's a few years older than I am, so he's been my teacher for many, many years, and I love watching him navigate a space, because, you know, a restaurant will just leave on sort of obnoxious background music that drives him crazy, and immediately he wants that off, he wants his drink, he disrupts the flow of bodies and their normal behavior. There's something very beautiful about that. He's not aggressive in it. You know, if you think about how much energy it takes to occupy a space, it's actually a great question. How much energy does it take to occupy that space for you, right? At a, you know, hole-in-the-wall Chinese restaurant, certain people feel greatly at ease, and certain people feel very dis-at-ease, right? They feel very uncomfortable, and that's an enormous expenditure of energy, that dis-ease. They don't know what to do. There's anxiety there. Body is being taxed. Same can be said of a very fancy restaurant. Certain people just feel at ease there, right? And certain people don't. In fact, if I'm going out, I don't frankly like to go out to restaurants even or bars, because I'm particular about my space. I like it. I want a certain freedom to move about, to mix my drink just to my liking, to not have to wait, to make my food to my exact specifications. To me, that's so decadent to stay in, so liberating. That decadence is the ability just to luxuriate in my appetites and desires. I know people see eating out as a decadence, but I see it as a put upon, as a constraint. It can be nice, and you can learn all kinds of things. I'm not categorically judging the experience of eating out, but I'm thinking about how spaces dictate us and how we expend our energy. What is asked of us in those spaces, in those places, digestively and behaviorally, to maximize our flow, our state of being, our vitality, our health. It's a great litmus really for anything, right? For any mode of doing anything, right? How much energy do I need to expend doing this, being in this place? I think about classrooms and something I used to do often in the beginning of a semester back when I was teaching. I would ask students to say, give a reading of the space we're in. Give a reading of the space we're in. And sometimes it's a big lecture hall and the seats are nailed to the floor. They're all lined up in a kind of U around a stage where I'm standing at a podium, right? There's then there are these doors. I remember these doors in this one lecture hall. At Berkeley, and I think this is a pretty common thing. There's a door, and there's a very small window. That window is not for looking out from the classroom. It's not to give you a view. Right? It's too small, and it looks on just into the hallway. But also, it's too small. You can't see anything outside of it. That window is for looking in. It's for people on the outside to look in. Once I realized that, I understood Foucault's reading the Panopticon, Discipline and Punish, in which schools, hospitals, and prisons share this kind of panoptic architecture. Things can be looked at. Your behavior is looked at as you're doing your thing privately. You don't get to look out. They look at you. You modulate your behavior accordingly. So I used to ask my students to read the space they're in. Right, to kind of create this alienation of the assumptions of a space, because that's precisely where sort of power exists. Power exists in the forgetting or the repression of the rules of a space. We just assume this is what you do. So in a classroom, people walk in, they sit in their seats. You can't adjust your seat. You can't move it to a different angle. They're nailed in place. And everything's looking towards the front of the room. There are these doors with these windows that look in, not out. And immediately I see a sort of a power structure, right? A whole hierarchy of the undifferentiated students in the crowd, the privileged, phallic professor. But that phallus is itself maintained and controlled by forces that are leering through that window. You can call that paranoid. It's not paranoid. There are other ways that space can be used. I'm not saying that is the only use of that space. I'm saying that is one reading of the way of that space, the way of the classroom. I mentioned this to juxtapose this with this school that my 13-year-old son is going to. Called Brightworks here in San Francisco. That it's this incredible school. It's experimenting, and one of the things that it's experimenting with is space, is the distribution of bodies. When you walk into Brightworks, there's no chairs with the teacher in front. In fact, there's very few chairs except in that sort of little dining area. There are makeshift bean bags and cushions, and in each room, I won't call them a classroom, there are maybe 10 people altogether, teachers and students, sometimes less, and they build their space. It's the first thing they do at the beginning of each year, is each group sort of builds its space. And some are up in these sort of tree houses, these loft spaces. Some are wedged down below under them. And a group together creates their space. I am not suggesting one is better than the other, although I like the bright workspace. My point is just to show that the minute you begin thinking about the distribution of bodies, the flow of knowledge, the relationships between identity and space, schools, right, these different kinds of classrooms become so different, because they're looking for a different mode of education. And clearly, the relationship between space and pedagogic models is a topic that far exceeds this rambling rant about space and power. Classrooms are a great way to think about it. Another way to think about it is parks, or relationships sort of between the urban and what we call the natural. And then there's parks and hiking spaces. And I've been spending a lot of time in Golden Gate Park here in San Francisco, which is, it's an interesting park. It's really kind of spectacular. It's very long. It's not very wide, but it's very long. And as you get to, towards the west end of it, it ends at the ocean, which is an incredible experience. And I think that experience, that sort of geology, the geography of the space, helps create or is constitutive of the creation of a kind of behavior. At that west end of the park, there's a kind of wildness, and there are sort of paths that meander, and they put a lot of paths down. You can walk on the sort of sidewalk of some of the streets, but at any point there are paths cutting off. And any place there can be a path, they put a path. You can sort of meander through the woods a little bit. And while it never, of course, approaches, Yosemite or the Sierras or something like that, it's not so vast. But it gives you the whiff of this kind of disorientation of space, this kind of immersion in the vegetal and plants and such. It's very different, is my point, than, let's say, Central Park in Manhattan, which is really sort of architected for the stroll, for the spectacle, there's always a little cement path that winds up and over with benches, and it's very European in that sense, in that it's built to look at each other, to push your pram with your child and take your woman out for a walk. Doesn't mean there aren't possibilities of solitude and frolicking in Central Park. It's that the space asks something different of us than Golden Gate Park. They're simply different modes of operation, and those are cultural, they're historical, they're architectural, and they're geographic, and they're social. These things all are working together. I think the fact that Golden Gate Park, obviously it's in San Francisco, there's a greater sort of deference, a greater presence of, for lack of a better word, I'll call the natural. It doesn't reek of the urban. It's not loud. There's only like 750,000 people here. It's not big. It's not Manhattan. But that all said, Manhattan is an island, right? They could have emphasized the islandness of it. But something about the way it became configured and the impinging or the presence of these other forces, the forces of the ocean and of the rivers, they're felt in New York, but not so much. Not like here in San Francisco. Not like at Golden Gate Park, where it empties into the ocean. You walk out of Golden Gate Park at the end, and you're at the fucking ocean, man. I mean, it's spectacular. It's sort of incredible, and you can smell it and feel it in the texture of the air. That combined with a certain culture out here, a certain mode of behavior, lends itself to acting differently. You act differently in this park than in that park. And it can be confusing if you're coming from one to the other. Right? It's taken me many, many years. I've been in San Francisco now 26 years to truly begin delving deeply into the park. I thought I sort of had, but I realized I always sort of treated it more like Central Park. For me, Riverside Park in Manhattan, sort of city park. So you have classrooms and parks, and then, of course, all different kinds of city streets. Again, but ask a different kind of behavior of us. They move bodies in a different way. And the thing that really got me thinking about this, besides the fact that what else is there to think about, man, social, this is what we should be thinking about, right? How do I find my ease in a given space? How can I go with this space in a way that serves my vitality without an excessive or wasting expenditure of energy? How hard do I need to work to find a kind of simpatico, a kind of going with, a kind of joy, and even perhaps a vitality, right? The space is not neutral. There might be something in this space that allows me to actually increase my energy. I think hot tubs, which take some energy, but, a float tank. Or the thing that's prompted this whole line of inquiry is my visiting in the past month or so, two different sort of hot springs here in Northern California, clothing optional hot springs. I'm a guy who goes clothed. I'm a clothed guy. I don't spend a lot of time naked. I live alone. I don't strip down and hang out on my couch naked. My friends aren't naked. I've seen them. We're not prudish. Someone might walk out of the shower. I've seen this and that of different friends, and it's a non-issue. At the same time, nudity is not the everyday mode in my living. And in fact, often, nudity really only exists for two reasons. Either we're cleaning, changing, cleaning, grooming, or, we're entering the sexual, right? That's how I know. Those are the terms with which I participate in nudity. So it was, for me, going to hot springs, which you take off your clothes and you're surrounded by all these other people without clothes. It took me a little. I had to learn its way, We can say, it's more natural to be naked. That's absurd. There's no natural, there's no cultural. It's all cultural and it's all natural. So for me, it's very unnatural to have my clothes off around other people that I'm not... imminently enjoying, as it were. So what happens? I get to this space, and I want to say my guard is up, but that's excessive. There's a kind of feeling out. But my identity is at risk there. It's like, how am I, as a naked person, to stand towards these people? This is a space with really different, fundamentally sort of different terms, the distribution of bodies and behavior. What happens when I'm naked? How much do I talk to somebody else? Now, just to be clear, you're not like hanging out naked outside of a certain area. You're not cooking naked or anything like that, but it's sort of a resorty thing, and it's sort of rustic resort. So you're in a contained space to be honest, it's not just the nudity. You also cook there. There's a communal kitchen, and you bring in your food. There's nothing to buy. There's no restaurant, and you're sort of always navigating the space between the very private. I was there with a lady friend, and most people are there with some sort of lover. Sometimes there's groups of friends, but you're in your own little cocoon with that person. But at the same time, it's a public space. You're cooking in public with the kitchen. Again, we're clothed at that point, but you're not dressed all fancy, right? You're in this big industrial kitchen, and then there's the nudity side of it. But in both instances, I've sort of thrown back on myself because I had to learn to participate in these spaces. And there's something just in and of itself that's just fucking fantastic about that. Just what's happening here? And I, as a human being, as an individual, as me, am implicated by identity. I get a little anxious. My first instinct is to get a little defensive and judge it. I don't like this. I don't like this. Of course, I don't like it. Why be there? So that's an idiotic response. It's a very rare sort of space, a very rare sort of experience. You don't really go someplace where, you know, you cook communally with strangers, with your stuff, and you're naked, and you're, you know, like, it's something very different is asked of you that's rare. So my first gut instinct is to reject, right, is to become a little hostile. But in my mode, it becomes, you know, thought through. I have a concept. I have a reason why it's not the right thing. But I know that's all idiotic because then I just don't have to be there. But if I'm there, what are its terms? What are its ways of going? And how do I, this particular guy who wears these particular things and situates himself in a certain social semiotics over, you know, 47 and a half years, How is he to adjudicate, negotiate, participate in this other space? The fact is, it didn't take me a long time, but it took me some time of trying to sort of first deal with the immediate gut defensive reaction, right? And just sort of shed that and realize what was personal discomfort versus what still needed to be learned is what I'm saying. What still needed to be learned rather than feeling a disease and then forming an argument to justify that disease. That is really the general way of the world. We don't like something and then we come up with a theory and a practice and a concept and even perhaps a set of dictums and rules and laws about why we don't like it and why it should even be forbidden, as opposed to just saying, well, let me check it out. Or maybe I don't like it, and maybe then I don't have to come anymore. It was this sort of interesting experience being, for me, this sort of, you know, square, some sort of square, you know, New York urban person, dude, trying to figure out this sort of Northern California hippie naked environment, where I'm, you know, again, my relationship to nudity is to be is sexualized. But now I know that's not right, right? I know that if I see a naked woman at this place, I don't come on to her. We're not about to have sex. That's ridiculous. It's absurd. But that's how I think about the nudity. So, of course, what does one do? What do? I don't look at anybody. I try not to look. I don't know what to do with it, so I don't look. But then I find over the few days I'm there, you know, there's different ways of looking. There's different ways of just of engaging the nudity of another body. And it runs from the sort of banal, you know, it's just you're nude, which, you know, frankly, creeps me out a little bit, but that's a different thing. Sometimes it was actually rarely sexualized, but at one point sort of sexualized when, I'm there with a woman and there's a guy and he starts hanging around us and following us to the different pools and talking about things. And then at some point wants to comment on my lady friend's beauty and we're alone in this pool naked. And it's, it immediately becomes all too apparent that the participation in the space and the discourse which distributes the bodies is, gender is one of those distributions, right? The way the men and women can stand towards each other, the way my friend who took me there, the way she likes to go there, she's naked a lot, she's been looked at, and she's a woman who negotiates the gaze in this very different way than I do. My point being that when you begin thinking through the way of a space, when you begin thinking through the energetics and the energy and the modes of practice to find your ease in that space, These things are their gender, their cultural, where you're from in the country, how your parents were like, relationship to nudity, in your whole life. There's so many sort of forces at work, all the way down to just you being there. And what do you want? And how will you stand there? How will you be there? How will you find your posture, your poise, your position amidst these other bodies? It is a task. And the fact that it's a task, right? Unlike you walk in a restaurant and that behavior is already determined. Going into a clothing optional spa, you know, in a sort of nudie spa, is beautifully alienating, is invigoratingly alienating, in that I've sort of thrown back on myself, and the terms of the space sort of reveal themselves, or I try to negotiate them. I look for them. They may not just reveal themselves, but they are revealed necessarily just by the nature of the space. And you know, it's kind of luxurious, so that even when there's this guy sort of sniffing around myself and my lady friend, you know, for me there was a little social discomfort because I simply didn't know what to do. But her take on it was so great. She's like, first of all, you know, you can consider it flattering, but also in another sense, it's okay to have a little bit of a space, be sexualized, right? That's a very uncommon experience. In a way, our public spaces are inundated, run through with the sexual and the erotic, and a gaze that can be quite menacing. On the other hand, they are conspicuously stripped and bereft of a certain kind of erotic or sexual expression, and so just being in a different space in and of itself becomes kind of interesting. And then I, of course, I took to it rather wholeheartedly. It's very decadent and luxurious, and for various reasons. Mostly, you get to occupy this space in this kind of way. You don't have to rush through it. You don't feel like you're trespassing or bothering people. Just to lay down on the field, to sit in a chair, to just begin cooking somewhere in this other kitchen. That's not an experience one has often. And I found it, and continue to find it, tremendously decadent, in that I use this word decadent, or luxurious, maybe is what I mean. It's luxurious. It's high luxury. Because it involves minimal energy expenditure. I make the food I want. You can say that's an expenditure of energy, but it's the opposite, because I'm creating the thing that's going to fuel me. Or it's not the opposite, it's an expenditure, but I'm creating the thing that's going to fuel my energy, right? So it's a good exchange. Unlike a restaurant, where food might be salty or gross, you're picking out certain things, you don't quite like it. You're expending energy, making all kinds of decisions, and then digesting, and then living with your gustatory elementary decisions, you know, for the rest of the evening. So, you know, in fact, it's all to say that a space has all sorts of rules, all sorts of ways of coercing bodies, of dictating your behavior, and ways that we come to those spaces, the assumptions we have about them, and how we should act in them, and the kinds of energies and demands that makes on us. That's really all I'm sort of interested in, right? It's really the relationship between the energetics of being and the architecture of spaces. The architecture being both visible and invisible, the way the space is constructed and facilitates a certain flow of being, a certain way of going.